This is River to River. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day. Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney winds up a two-day visit to Des Moines, just as President Barack Obama's campaign schedules a three-day campaign trek across Iowa next week. What's the strategy in choosing cities, and what are the candidates stressing? We'll be talking with political scientist Bruce Nesmith and Tim Hagel and getting your comments, too. We're talking politics today on River to River, right after the NPR News. Politics Day on River to River. Bruce Nesmith, co-college professor of political science, is here. Hello, Bruce.
Good afternoon, Dean.
Tim Hagel, right, Mike's side also.
Howdy.
Nice to have you here. Well, Iowa's role as a state whose electoral votes are in the cusp of swinging either way, that's what we're called a swing state, I guess, is becoming increasingly evident. Mitt Romney, currently campaigning in central Iowa, appearances in Des Moines last night and this morning. President Obama coming to Iowa next week for 3 days of campaigning. I counted the cities. It's Council Bluffs, Boone, Oskaloosa, Marshalltown, Waterloo. Then Michelle Obama comes in to join him for stops in Dubuque and Davenport. And Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell covered his opponent, Republican candidate Mitt Romney, in Des Moines today. Joyce is in our Des Moines studio. Hello, Joyce.
Hello, Dean.
You covered the Romney campaign this morning, but you weren't there. He spoke last night, too. You weren't there, were you?
I wasn't there last night. That was a private event.
Yes.
Pool reporters were allowed in. That was at a gated community out in West Des Moines. Predictably drew a crowd of protesters, sort of a sharp contrast or a way to emphasize you know, that he's vulnerable to a charge of catering to the wealthy. At any rate, he had a very successful time last night. They were estimating that he would raise $1 million, and there are estimates today that he raised $2 million at that fundraiser last night. Yep.
But today, you were there today, and what was the theme?
Well, he emphasized his he was at a Central Campus, Des Moines Public School Auditorium in downtown Des Moines. A crowd of, I counted 500. I saw an estimate of 700. Crowd estimates are always tricky. But
yes.
He outlined his five-point plan for the middle class, which includes expanding trade, championing small businesses, reducing the deficit. And then he doubled down on this new issues that he's been bringing up about welfare reform. President Obama has issued an order giving the states more flexibility in how they implement welfare-to-work programs. Romney has focused on that and claimed that the president is eliminating the work requirement for welfare. This has been sharply criticized. PolitiFact gave it its pants on fire rating for lack of truthfulness.
You mean in what Romney is saying?
What Romney is saying, mm-hmm. Yeah. And but it's not surprising to me that he's continuing to use that in his speeches. It's you know, it's a predictable applause line. Here's Romney on the issue of welfare to work.
People who receive payments from government are going to be required to work. We must restore, and I will restore, work into welfare.
He went on to say that when he was governor of Massachusetts, he doubled up the work requirements for welfare recipients. But what he didn't say is that when he was governor of Massachusetts, he also asked for the same kind of flexibility waivers that the states, even Republican governors now, are asking for.
Now, Joyce, I'm going to bring Tim Hagel in here. Tim, that welfare law that was passed, the federal law requiring some work in order to draw welfare, that was enacted under a Democratic president.
It was, of course, a Republican Congress. And so at that point, Bill Clinton was using his triangulation where he was, you know, working with the Republican Congress and still trying to keep his Democratic base happy. So he more of a politician, less concerned about the actual positions than getting things done. And so, of course, Clinton has weighed in on this, too.
Bruce Nesmith, why is it a good issue for Romney if he could make it work?
Well, I think, you know, what he's trying to point to is the perception that Obama is not respective of American values. And certainly one of the American values is the value of work. So I think that's probably what this is speaking to.
And, Dean, I'll just add here that in his speech today, Romney said he went back to the history of it, which we're referring to here. It was a Clinton administration initiative. And a lot of Democrats really did resist it. They were concerned about leaving families out in the lurch. And Obama was one of them that he resisted that. And so Romney was kind of hearkening back to that. I guess Obama at that time made some arguments against it. And so now Romney is saying, see, he's all along he's resisted having welfare recipients work.
But it apparently is, Joyce, and our political scientist here, hitting a nerve because former President Clinton issued a statement this morning refuting the Romney claims. What else did you observe there? You said the crowd of about 500. I'm going to ask you about that. I saw the 700 estimate, too. You said you actually counted maybe 500.
Well, I did my best.
But I saw a photo that the Democratic Party is circulating that shows a whole bunch of empty seats toward the rear of the auditorium. I mean, a lot of empty seats.
Well, it was in an un-air-conditioned auditorium, as many public school facilities are. You know, to save money, the school doesn't air-condition its auditorium. And so they waited to the last minute to bring people in from – they were lined up outside. Mm-hmm. And it was much cooler outside than it was inside. So they waited to the last minute to bring them in. And then they filled the first half of the auditorium. 500 is that's not there's nothing slouchy about that. That's a good crowd on a weekday morning. And then the press was set up about halfway through the auditorium. Anybody sitting behind that would have had a hard time seeing. So that photo was frankly misleading.
So there's no reason to apologize, you're saying, for the crowd.
I don't think so.
Yeah, okay. Anything else, Joyce?
He's been some Iowa Republicans have taken him to task for not supporting wind energy tax credits. And not surprisingly, he didn't mention those tax credits, but he did make a general statement about one way to put people back to work is to encourage energy exploration and energy development. And he said, and that means all energy. And he mentioned wind, so he kind of covered himself there. And then he was criticized last night, apparently, in his appearance in West Des Moines. Earlier in the day, at all of his stops, he's making reference to the shooting in Wisconsin at the Sikh temple. And last night, just a verbal gaffe, he said "sheik" instead of "Sikh," and people were commenting on that. But he was careful to get that right today.
Thanks, Joyce.
Thanks
for giving us the insight today.
You're welcome,
Bruce. Let's go to the Obama visit. Suddenly, that's announced right on the heels of Governor Romney being here this week. We've known that Iowa was considered a swing state in this presidential election, but is there anything to explain the sudden intention and intense attention by President Obama?
Well, there are possible explanations, but I don't know which one is, if any of them is true. It could be that they want to have a shadow, so when Romney appears, they want somebody to follow on him.
But he's really making a statement. 3 days.
Yeah, well,
seven cities.
Yeah, this is going to be a close election. I think the map right now shows Obama with an electoral college advantage because he has small leads in a number of important states. But were he to lose, you know, just a couple percentage points in a variety of states, if something were to shift the ground by a couple of percentage points nationwide, every electoral vote continues to count, including Iowa's 6.
I think that's absolutely right, that when you've got these swing states, and the idea being is that maybe they had gone for Obama in 2008, but 2008 is not 2012 in terms of the enthusiasm shown for the Democratic nominee, obviously President Obama in this case, as opposed to then-Senator Obama, where coming off 8 years of a Republican administration, the wind was really the Democrats' back. And that's not the case now, because obviously the president has to run on his record or at least try to tout the successes that he's had. But when you look at the overall economic picture, it's going to be tough. And so he needs to really work hard, as he's doing, seemingly, to make sure that these states that seem to be in sort of a swing position that could go either way, that they stay in his column. So he's got to play more defense.
The Des Moines Register within the past week also profiled several counties that are very, very key to both Governor Romney and President Obama. As you read these cities, Council Bluffs, Boone, Oskaloosa, Marshalltown and Waterloo, then Dubuque and Davenport, do you see anything strategic in those, or is it just, let's throw a dart at the map?
Well, it's kind of a combination of things, I suppose, that obviously President Obama is going to have more success in the cities or our Iowa's version of urban areas. I know people in other states don't think anything place in Iowa is urban, but still, that's where he's going to have more success as opposed to the rural areas, and so that's where he's going to hit. So there's no surprise there. And even the Republicans, that generally they're going to go where more people are, so they're going to hit places that are more populated. But certainly that's where Obama has more success, and he's going to try to, again, energize his base.
And Bruce, he's finishing up in Davenport and Dubuque, very key, but also helpful in that congressional race for the Democrat.
Certainly all of the four are interesting in some way or another, but I think that's probably the one that's the closest.
Congressman Bruce
Braley and his opponent.
Ben Lang.
Yeah, Ben Lang.
You think that race is going to be closer than the third district between Latham and Boswell?
Maybe, maybe not.
Well,
I don't have any numbers on
Governor Romney was in Des Moines, too, to raise money for the campaign. In fact, he's been having a lot of success. The July numbers show that he outperformed President Obama in fundraising by a considerable number of million of dollars. Anything special meaning in that, Tim Hagel?
Bragging rights, I think, more than anything else. I was thinking about this on the way over here. If the fundraising numbers were low, then for either of the candidates, then they would worry about having enough money to do what they want to do in terms of turning out the vote, getting out their message, and so forth. But when we're talking about the kinds of numbers we're talking about for both campaigns, I'm not sure that it matters too much that one party or one candidate has outraised another, particularly month to month, that both of them will have plenty of money to get their message out. And certainly those of us in swing states like Iowa and others, we're going to see lots and lots of advertising. We'll have visits and so forth. So I don't think that they're going to be hurting for money. And I'm not sure that a little bit extra really makes that much difference, as I said, other than bragging rights.
Yeah. Over the past week, Senate Majority Leader Democrat Harry Reid made a claim in an interview, and that was with the Huffington Post, that Mitt Romney hasn't paid income taxes for the past 10 years, and he claims to have a credible source for that information, and despite repeated questioning, though, he isn't backing away from that claim. Here's what he said on the Senate floor.
The word's out that he hasn't paid any taxes for 10 years. Let him prove that he has paid taxes, because he hasn't. We already know from one partial tax return that he gave us, he has money hidden in Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, and a Swiss bank account. Not making that up, that's in the partial year that he gave us. Mitt Romney makes more money in a single day than the average middle-class family makes in 2 years or more.
There are some, Bruce Nesmith, who say that Harry, that's a hard claim for Harry Reid to back up, but also puts the Republicans on the defensive. Who do you think it hurts the most?
I think that that the Democrats feel like they have an issue here with Romney's tax returns, and Reid has his secret source. I don't know if this is a real person or not. Apparently, enough other Democrats are like Nancy Pelosi are confident enough that they're joining the chorus. I think that like the story of the tar baby, I think that they would like very much for Romney to release his tax returns and see what's in them. And this might be one way of teasing them out. I'm not sure if there's anything more significant than that going on.
That's exactly what it is, that basically they want to see his tax returns because they want to paint Romney as this out-of-touch rich guy. And they've been attempting to do that for quite some time, and they think that having more of these tax returns will show either deductions or whatever it happens to be and can talk about what the tax rate was and so forth. So they want to see more so that they have more to attack him. And Romney says, look, I've paid my taxes. I'm going to release a couple of years. I think that's all that's necessary. And so this is a way to try to force him. And it's interesting to see a number of people say, well, you know, Romney can solve this by just releasing the tax returns. Well, that's exactly what the Democrats want. So it plays right into the hand. But really, if you know, the Senate majority leader is going to use the authority of his office to make a claim, he should be able to back it up too, I think.
But the more I think about this, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and JFK weren't paupers. And so why does this work for the Democrats, Bruce?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that it is, other than, well, it is sort of but it's more complicated. I think that there has been no president in my memory who has been, you know, anything other than the top 1 or 2% of income. I think the phrase that Tim used earlier, which I think is the key one, is rich and out of touch. And so you get somebody like Roosevelt who is very wealthy but is able to project empathy versus at least the caricature of John Kerry in 2004 as somebody who is sort of so wealthy and married into money and off windsurfing and things like that. Yeah. And I think that the perception that the Democrats have had some success with is that Romney is not only fabulously wealthy but is beyond comprehension of what ordinary people do.
I'd like to know what our listeners think about the campaigning in Iowa so far, the incessant telephone surveys, and everything else that comes with being in the political spotlight like Iowa is right now. And what about the incessant claims that go back and forth that we've just been talking about, non-payment of taxes, welfare reform, and so on? The number to call is 866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. Do we expect that this is a way, Tim, that the campaign is going to continue very, very negatively without any positive, this is what I would do if I were president, not what this man has done wrong, up to the very last day?
We're starting to see that question a lot because, of course, you get a couple of really negative sorts of things like the Harry Reid thing and the other ad that a super PAC that supports Obama recently released that was roundly denounced. It's always difficult to put these things in perspective. I saw somebody tweet something that was a quote from I don't know who it was that was running against Jefferson in the 1800 election that was suggesting that, you know, incest and rape would be taught in schools if, you know, Jefferson won or something like that. And so things in the 1800s were pretty vicious too, and so it's all kind of relative. And we forget perhaps what even 4 years ago or 8 years ago, how there were certain nasty sorts of things. So we always can complain about these things, but negative advertising works. But on the other hand, I think the candidates will try to say the positive things, but they don't seem to get the same traction that the negative things do.
Well, we invited our listeners to call, but they lighted up the screen here. Jim in Iowa City. Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, hi. The question is posed why the
FDR
the
and JFK
for being a member of the 1% didn't go against John Kennedy or FDR. Well, that's because they didn't come in to represent the 1%. Mitt Romney clearly is the standard bearer of the 1%. His tax program favors the 1%. His economic policies favor the 1%. JFK and to a lesser degree, and FDR certainly were champions of the working class and, you know, working people in the middle class.
Okay.
That's why that and I just heard a new comment too that made me scratch my head. What is this widely criticized and debunked Super PAC ad on Obama's behalf. I mean, the incredible majority of the Super PAC money and ads are coming from the other side. I don't think it's I think it's really dishonest to jump down the throat of Democratic supporting Super PACs when the money is 10 to 1.
Thanks, Jim, for your comment. Tim, we're talking a lot about the middle class now, and especially President Obama wanting to strengthen the middle class, appealing to that middle class. Are you seeing class warfare here? Are we opening that?
Oh, sure. And this has been one of the things that the Republicans in the Romney campaign have been complaining about for some time. Let me go back to one thing, though, that the caller said, that his concern about the super PACs. And it may be that right now, or at least during the caucuses through now, we see most of the money going to the Republicans. But believe me, the Democrats will have plenty of money in super PACs. And the fact is that there was a super PAC this run by Bill Burton that I can't remember the name of the PAC specifically, but it put out the ad by this fellow that was talking about how his wife died of cancer and you know, very terrible and all of that. And he essentially blamed Mitt Romney for it. And many major outlets, I think the New York Times and some others, just came right out and said that there was no basis for this at all. So, you know, how much money goes to the Republican super PACs or Democrat is really irrelevant to the quality of that particular ad.
There's another call on the line, and he wants to know about the outrage and sort of questions that this Mr. Tollett, is it?
Actually, Paulette.
Go ahead.
Yes, I've heard a lot about Mr. Reed's comments in regards to Mr. Romney's tax returns, and there seems to be a lot of outrage, and yet when someone like Congressman King makes a remark about Mr. Obama's birth certificate being sent in from Kenya, there doesn't seem to be equal outrage because that's an unsubstantiated claim as well.
Any comment, Bruce?
There's plenty of outrage on either side, and this is I refer sometimes to the outrage industry. There's a lot of people out there making a lot of money out of getting people outraged. So I think what you have is people on the left and people in the Democratic Party, people in the Republican Party making various statements, some of which are maybe a little bit loosely factual, and hoping to see what sticks, and then the other side trying to drum up outrage among their own people about that statement.
Paulette, thanks so much for that call. I'm going to try to get Shannon on, who's calling from Muscatine, before we have to go to break. Shannon?
Hi. Yeah, I just disagree with that statement that the Democrats are painting Romney as wealthy and out of touch. And I hear a lot of media talking heads discussing that, you know, Democrats are upset that he's rich. For me, I don't begrudge him his money. But when he makes statements like, if you can't afford college, you may have to borrow some from your parents, that is out of touch. When his wife makes statements on TV when pressed about the tax returns and she says, we've shown you people enough, to me, he is hiding something.
Would
his religion.
Would you say those are gaffes that are going to cost him the election?
I think absolutely, because I think it's going to hurt him with independence.
Thanks so much, Shannon. We're going to take a break right now for some news. And then we'll be back talking with Bruce Nesmith and Tim Hagel about the presidential campaign, vice presidential selection, and other items as we approach the election of November 2012. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. And I'm Dean Borg, continuing the exchange, and we have with us political scientist Bruce Nesmith from Cole College in Cedar Rapids and Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa here in Iowa City. And we're going to be, as I invited callers a little bit ago, our screen just has lighted up, and I'm going to bring Kay on from Des Moines because she was at the Romney rally in Des Moines this morning. I'm going to bring her on just in a moment. And then I'm going to bring on Judy from Martinsdale, who's going to be talking about the tone of the campaign. But let's go to Kay in Des Moines, first of all. Kay?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You were at the rally today.
I was, and I got a chance to shake Mitt's hand and ask him a question because I was concerned about his position on Social Security.
What did you ask?
I asked him, I read in his position papers that he wanted to raise the age to full retirement for Social Security, and I asked him just how high he thought the age limit should be, and he would not answer that question.
What did he say? Did he say, I won't answer it, or how did he react?
No, because I explained to him that, I have to work till I'm 67, that's 50 years in the workforce, and that, a period of my career I was working construction, and I said, I don't think I could have done that job for 50 years, and so I don't know how much longer are you expecting people to work? And so he says, well, you don't have to work more, you're 67 for you. And I said, well, I'm not worried about me. I'm concerned about the other people. How long do you propose that they should work? And then he just kind of changed the subject about life expectancy going up. And I said, well, maybe it's going up because people can retire with dignity.
Well, what was your overall impression? You were disappointed you didn't get a direct answer, but did you go to the event thinking that you were a Romney supporter? Is that why you were there?
Well, I went to find out, why other people are interested in him, and I was talking to other people in the crowd, and they were very anti-Obama. But when I'd asked them, just what is it you like about Mitt Romney or his position, I couldn't get anybody that said why they want to vote for him other than anti-Obama.
Who are you likely to vote for if the election were this minute?
I'd vote for Mr. Obama.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks so much for giving us that firsthand update. Let's go now to Judy, and she has just an overall appraisal of the entire campaign. Judy, you're calling from Martinsdale.
Yes, I am. Thank you for taking my call. I've been listening to a lot about the campaign on the television, the various media outlets, as well as, of course, being in Iowa.
Have you been getting telephone calls, too?
No, fortunately, I have not been getting telephone calls. I think I have my number somehow hid.
Well, what do you think about all that you're seeing?
Well, I'm really disappointed in the tone of the campaign. I think that the ads are so negative on both sides. And I'm a Democrat, and I will vote for President Obama. But it comes down to values. I examine what are my values, and in terms of government, I look for government to take care of those people who cannot take care of themselves, to level the playing field so that everybody has a fair chance at competing in a fair manner.
Okay, that's what you would like. But in the campaign, you said you're disgusted and disappointed with the campaign. What would you rather see than the way it's being conducted right now?
Oh, I would rather see the issues such as debt, education, energy being discussed in a purposeful, policy-driven discussion as opposed sound bites.
You say you're a Democrat. Do you think that President Obama's letting you down by not discussing those issues with you?
Yes, I do. I think that both candidates are, and I expect better of our candidates that are seeking the highest office in this land, particularly at this time when we have so many issues and problems that confront us. And I think I believe both candidates can do better, and I blame both them and their handlers for going after the lowest common denominator.
Thank you very much for calling, Judy. And with Bruce Nesmith, does she strike a chord there?
Yes. I think I could just repeat what Judy said, and probably that would be all I need to say. But let me tie in a little bit of what Kay, the earlier caller, said. There are a number of issues that are really pressing in terms of the next few years. I think probably the most pressing is still the economy, but there are a number of others that they mention, and one of them is the debt. And part of addressing the debt is going to be addressing entitlement programs. Social Security, maybe not as much as Medicare and Medicaid, but one of the issues in dealing with the debt is going to be how do we restructure Social Security and the other entitlement programs so they make them sustainable. I think there's a real political vulnerability in coming out with your solution before the other side has come out with their solution. I think that historically what happens is people who come out with proposals to deal with entitlements tend to get political advantage taken of them rather than a debate joined.
I'm going to give Tim Hagel a chance to respond there, and then I'm going to bring on a caller who plays right to what you're saying. Go ahead.
Just to quickly follow up on what Bruce was just saying is that, as I was thinking that asking a question on, and I think my impression was that it was on the rope line when she asked the question, that it's not really a good place to talk, you know, deep policy usually because you're in a hurry to get out. And even if it was in part of the regular questioning as a town hall type kind of thing, Bruce is right that you want to be careful about laying out something specific like that, especially a hot topic like that, where it's going to really have to be a bipartisan discussion as far as how that's going to change. As far as the tone question, in thinking about this morning, I was thinking, well, you know, as voters, we have to hold these folks responsible somehow. And it's really difficult to know how to hold them responsible because we don't have much control over what the message is. And we all know, and we said before, that negative advertising works. But I think as voters, we can let our party know, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, say, you know, I just don't care for that kind of negativity, and let them know about it. And as far as the positions, I would think that both candidates will have things up on their websites. We'll hear more of the specific stuff in the debates and in more extended formats.
We were speaking earlier of welfare reform and that being raised now in the refutation that President Clinton made this morning. Radena and I is calling from Waterloo. Am I saying that name correctly? Radena?
It's Radena.
Radena, okay. But you have a comment about welfare reform and you resent it.
Yes, I do. I have a comment and it's going to be quick. But I think the tone of Mitt Romney's campaign has taken a new low because he has now begun playing the hidden language of playing the race card. And the reason I say that is by linking Obama with, I would say, a negative sense of welfare reform to the Republican Party, there is probably not an African-American person in the United States that does not realize he is really saying he is going to start handing out checks to poor, uneducated black people who don't want to work and are unwilling to work. Mm-hmm. And I think that he is appealing to people that have those stereotypes. And stereotypically, that is exactly what they're going to think,
Radena,
by linking him to welfare reform.
Radena, I am glad you raised that because I'm going to ask Tim Hagel if he reads that also into it. Thanks for calling, Radena.
Well, it's certainly true that people are going to have that impression. Some folks are going to have that impression, and you hear about the hidden language and subtle references, sorts of things, and maybe that's the belief. But I just can't see that that's really what Romney is getting at, even though it's probably true that some people do have those stereotypes, unfortunate as that is.
Why, Bruce, would she believe that playing the race card in this would assist Governor Romney in his campaign?
Well, I think.
Why, if that were indeed true?
Yeah, if it were true, I think what you don't want to do is be very blatant about it. So you'd want to be subtle.
But
and
what advantage would that give Governor Romney?
Well, I think what that does is maybe let me stop stammering and take a step back and look at the broader election right now, which we had a report at the top of the hour. The National News talked about 4-5% undecided in the poll in the states where these polls were taken. We have a very close election with very few votes that are out there up for grabs. Pretty much, we're looking at who mobilizes their base better, who does better in swing states, and who can compete for those remaining undecided votes. And the perception may be, I don't have any data to back this up, the perception may be that a lot of those undecided votes in swing states may be white voters who may be suspicious of welfare recipients.
And to follow up on that, and not to be too cynical about this, but then we can take that a step further and say, well, on the other hand, perhaps the Obama campaign wants to energize its base by injecting race and suggesting that the other side is playing the race card to try to energize. So, yeah. You know, you can go round and round on this, and it's one of those things. Now we're back to talking about the tone again, and that sure. really doesn't help it.
Let's spend a little bit of time now. We'll go off of the phones and talk just to our political analysts here for a little bit on the vice presidential possibilities. Now, the list of speakers was released within the past few days at the Republican National Convention. That's the end of August, I think August 27th through the 30th, if I remember right. And that led to speculation as you look down the list of speakers there that prominent Republicans who aren't listed may be on Governor Romney's short list as vice presidential candidates and therefore don't expose them early in the program there. Now, is there anything to that sort of an idea, Tim?
Well, my first reaction is no. But, you know, it could be. But, you know, Romney was essentially asked about this because you can say, well, the people that aren't on the program, are they still on the short list? Does it mean that the people that are on the program announce speakers that they're not on the short list? And Romney just basically kind of smiled when he was asked about this and said, well, you know, we're perfectly capable, and I'm paraphrasing here, of throwing you a head fake. And so the list can be changed. It's not set in stone. And, you know, the process for him is ongoing. And I think that right now what it does is it signals to certain constituent groups that we're going to have a diverse speaker list, but it doesn't necessarily close out that maybe somebody that's not on the list could be the VP nominee, or somebody that is on the list could be the VP nominee.
I think the history is that in the modern era, we haven't had a vice presidential candidate speak before Wednesday or Thursday night, before they're nominated.
Mm-hmm. Now, not on that list mm-hmm. is New Jersey Governor Christie, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty.
Sarah
I'm not
Palin.
On the list. Sarah Palin. Are those very prominent people that you think might be a vice presidential selection?
Well, they could be. There are a variety of people that aren't on the list. They could be on the short list still. And the names, of course, that are being thrown around, ones I talked about this morning. Of course, Paul Ryan of Wisconsin and Rob Portman of Ohio and Pawlenty of Minnesota and a few others as well that are still sort of out there, including some of the people that are on that speaker's list. So, again, it's even, you know, Bruce is right that you wouldn't want to have somebody that speaks before, that's the nominee candidate that speaks
sure.
beforehand, but that
upstage
can be
himself.
That can be changed.
Yeah. Any speculation, Bruce, as to what attributes, I mean, if you were just looking mm-hmm. now at a vice presidential possibility for Governor Romney, what might he be looking at in choosing? Geographic location, male, female? You can go on from there.
I would say less geographical location. That used to be a pretty strong consideration back in the day, but less so now. Neither Delaware nor Wyoming, the last two successful vice presidential candidates, were particularly important states. I think you're looking for somebody who speaks to some group out there that you're looking for and who is capable of carrying attacks. It's though we don't have enough attacks in this campaign.
Attacks. You're not T-A-X.
No, I'm talking about A-T-T-A-C-K-S. Somebody who can – so the presidential candidates can somewhat rise above the fray. The vice presidential candidates become the goads or the attack dogs, so mm-hmm. to speak.
Mm-hmm. Tim?
Well, one of the things that's come up, and I think Romney himself has said this, is that he wants to pick somebody who can step in as president. Well, that's the obvious kind of thing. And that was the thing that a lot of people in particular criticized Palin about, whether the criticism was justified or not is irrelevant. That's what the criticism was. Yeah. that's going to be a big consideration for Romney. He certainly doesn't – I guess the key criterion is do no harm sort of thing, where he doesn't want to make a mistake, somebody that's going to be open to some heavy criticism, not unlike what happened with Palin.
Right.
And so he's going to look for that, but also somebody that gets along with Romney, perhaps somebody that can also articulate the economic message, and that's why Ryan and Portman seem to be at the top of the list. You talk about Pawlenty that kind of has that working class, blue-collar background that perhaps offsets Romney's background a little bit. So there are pros and cons to a lot of these folks.
What about the people who are on the speaking list right now? We know they're going to be speaking at the convention. Condoleezza Rice is one of them. Does that say anything about, I mean, the people, I assume that you have gone down the list and see who might be speaking there. Any choices there on the speaking list, Tim, that really would show Republican strategy in exposing these people at the convention?
Well, it's as one of the articles that we read before coming in today is the idea that it shows a certain diversity, that having a number of women on the speaking platform, including Governor Martinez of New Mexico and Condi Rice and so forth, Nikki Haley, you know, these female governors showing to try to strengthen the Republican Party's usually gets less votes from women voters, especially single women. So try to bolster that vote a little bit, show that diversity, plus a variety of experts. You have the governors, you have Condi Rice, who has that experience in the executive branch, a secretary of state and foreign policy and so forth. So, you know, it's basically the same thing. And the Democrats will do the same thing, trying to reach out to a variety of audiences and to give certain people a speaking position to talk to certain constituencies like the Rand Paul situation.
Before we leave the convention, anything more you want to say on that?
I think we're fine.
Okay. You've rung it out, okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's turn now to the Iowa Supreme Court retention vote. Let's come back here to Iowa. If you want to say something about the congressional campaigns, bring that in too. You may have something that I'm not thinking of here right now. But Supreme Court Justice David Wiggins is on the November general election ballot for a yes or no, up or down referendum on continuing to serve on the Iowa Supreme Court. Now, the Iowa Republican Party Chair, A.J. Spiker, has formally now put the State Party Central Committee on record calling for Justice Wiggins to be removed, just as three other justices were 2 years ago removed because of the Iowa Supreme Court's decision that Iowa's law defining marriage is only for a man and a woman, opening the door for same-sex marriages. Very controversial decision. It was unanimous by the Supreme Court, but many conservative groups targeted then and were successful in removing those three. Now the Iowa Republican Party, which didn't last time, but, Tim, the Iowa Republican Party this time has, with A.J. Spiker, saying Wiggins needs to go too. What's the significance there in the Republican Party going on record as doing this?
You know, I wasn't aware that the Republican Party hadn't gone on record 2 years ago. If they hadn't, you know, I think that it might have been certain concerns about mixing what was going on in that recall or rejection of the retention, kind of an odd phrasing there, versus the gubernatorial election, where now with different people in the party, they want to be more forceful in terms of what their position is, or maybe felt that the RPI was too timid the last time around. Mm-hmm. The question still would be as to how much they're going to support it. It's one thing to go on record saying, okay, we think that this person should be removed, but are they going to do anything about it? Are they going to focus on either the state legislative races or the presidential race and so forth? So I'm not sure that it's going to be a priority for the Republican Party and for a variety of groups the way it was last time. I know some people are going to push it, but on the other hand, it's been another 2 years. I think that a lot of the anger has subsided. As I've sometimes said to folks, the sky has not fallen. We haven't had any, you know, disastrous incidents of something that's happened with some couple that's gotten married and then maybe had to get divorced or something of that nature. So I'm not sure that it's going to generate the interest that it did 2 years ago.
That's where you feel, Bruce?
I do, and for that reason, I was actually rather shocked at Chairman Spiker's statement. This seems to me to be crossing a line that is not easily uncrossed. And if we're not going to put a lot of effort into, you know, taking all the judges off the Supreme Court, it's a rather odd statement to make.
But I noticed Joy Corning, who was a former lieutenant governor of Iowa, she took it upon herself to issue a statement in what she, a former governor, Joy Corning of Cedar Falls, called it sad and appalling to inject politics into the judicial system. What's this indicating, Tim Hagel, about Iowa's Republican Party?
Well, I don't know that what it means as far as Republican Party. Certainly there are going to be differences in the Republicans on their view on the issue, both in terms of gay marriage specifically, but also the judicial role in this, as there are differences among Democrats. But the thing that I think is one response to that when I see comments along those lines is they complain about injecting politics into the judicial branch, but what Republicans would counter with is saying the politics are already there and we're trying to get those folks removed.
I see. Well, I'm wondering, it may be a way, too, of ginning up a base.
Well, that's sort of the immediate thought.
Yeah. Well, thanks, gentlemen, for your views, and thanks to everyone for listening and calling in. Lively Hour. Bruce Nesmith, co-college professor of political science. Tim Hagel, the University of Iowa political scientist. And River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins. A lot of help today from Catherine, Alex Hoyer, and Emily Woodbury. Executive producer Jeff Schmidt. Assistance today from Allison Sullivan, Dennis Reese, and John Pemble in Des Moines. I'm Dean Borg, and River to River is produced by Iowa Public Radio News.